This is Chasing Encounters, a podcast about stories, languages, cultures, and identities. We highlight diversity and intersectionality in contemporary society through respectful and thought-provoking conversations. Welcome, everybody. This is Yacine Ortega. This is Chasing Encounters, season number 3. Episode number 5. Today we have Mike in the microphone. I was going to say Mike in the mic.
Yeah, that would have been a good one.
In the microphone today. Thanks for coming. Thanks for accepting the invitation. Long overdue. You know, I've been following you on social media and all, you know, your YouTube channel, you know, you name it. And I think, at least for me, it was super important to have this conversation today. And then I'll tell you later what I would like to discuss with you, because I think we share similar paths, history related to music and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But let me get started with the name, actually, because I think on social media at some point you mentioned your name. I know your name is Mike Mina, but I wonder if maybe you can unpack a little bit about the history about how Mike, as opposed to being called Michael.
Oh yeah, that's pretty interesting. So, starting with my family, I actually go by Daniel, and then in school, you know how they call you by your first name, so it ended up turning into Michael, and then it ended up turning into Mike with my friends, and then when I moved to New York, everybody started mispronouncing my name to Mike Mina instead of Mena. And I think I was in, I don't know, maybe probably 6, 7, 8 classes where all the professors pronounced my name Mike Mina. It was something that really threw me off, and I had to adjust to it, because coming from a 90% Latino-Latina population, never hearing your name explicitly whitened, it was something I had to get adjusted to, because every time a white professor pronounced my name Mike Mina, it pretty much set the stage for all the students to start pronouncing my name Mike Mina. And you know, how are you supposed to correct you know, your professor in front of the class, you know? And how are you and how are you supposed to know which professors are going to mispronounce your name? I guess I should have started, you know, predicting it, but I don't know. It's not something that you want to walk in as a graduate student and immediately tell the professor, "Hey, this is my name. Please pronounce it correctly." it's not something, and especially for me as you know, a Latino student in New York, coming from Texas, coming from a Latinx population, feeling very outside of academia. Most of the time, not ever at home, I felt really secure in my intellectual abilities, etc. But once I stepped out of my home and came over here to New York, where it's, you know, allegedly a very diverse place, you inevitably walk into a white institution, even if you're white, even if your institution is considered diverse, technically, you know. And that was just one extra linguistic way that I was positioned as not only outside the institution, but it felt like I was positioned outside of my minoritized community in the classroom. So it was something very jarring, very disturbing to me. And it continues. I mean, it still happens.
Right.
It just happened yesterday, actually. You know, but I don't know, is that a battle that I want to fight every single day? I mean, you get tired, you know, you don't want to have this conversation every single time you introduce yourself to somebody new, you know, but inevitably in academia, in education in general, you're going to run into that problem, and you got to decide individually whether or not you're going to take the time to correct every single person that misnames you.
No, it's interesting that you're saying this, because obviously the same thing happened to me. Similar, my name is Yacid, spelled Y-E-C-I-D, And a lot of people, especially when I travel to the United States, you know, I live in Chicago for 10 years. So a lot of people would call me Yazid, Yahin, Yazid. And then you're right. Like, we get tired of trying to explain to them how the name is pronounced, to the point that to this date, when I introduce myself in different circles, I don't say my name is Yazid. I just say my name is James. And that's pretty much it. I just say, what's your name? My name is James. And then like people call me James in different spaces. Because I know at the end of the day, if it is like a show or some places that I go that I know they're going to meet me just for one day, I don't say my name because they will forget me. But if it is something very important, then I disclose my name. I'm engaged in conversations. But I just do, even at Starbucks, I always say, oh, my name is James. Because they don't pronounce it well, you know. I go to Starbucks, what's your name? James. Because if I say my name, Yazid, they will misspell it, they will mispronounce it, and then it would get me mad, and I don't want to get me mad, and I also don't want to be this person who is always educating people about people's names, so I just sometimes give up. But I hear you. I hear what you're saying, and I think I share the same sentiment. So in the end, you prefer to be called Mike Mina or Mina?
Whenever I'm in any kind of institutional setting, I will always say Mike Mena.
Okay.
It depends on whether or not I'm going to talk to this person again and again. Then maybe I'll correct that person. Or if I really need the person to know who I am correctly, like, you know, if it was a professor or a colleague or something that I know that I'm going to interact with again in the future, I don't want them to get into the habit of mispronouncing my name, and then it gets more and more and more awkward for me to actually correct them later on in the future. So it just really depends person to person.
Makes totally sense.
Nice. Yeah, it's a tiring experience. It's a tiring battle, and to do it with something as easy as your name, or what you think would be as easy as your name, but you know, it's
right. So you were mentioning your Latinx background. I would like to ask you specifically that question about your Latinx background. I'm assuming that your parents were born in Latin America, or your great-grandparents. So maybe you can unpack a little bit about your parents, maybe brothers, sisters, or your little community where you grew up. I'm very interested in this background.
Right. Okay, so I am a second generation? Let me see. First generation Mexican American. My grandparents, or one of my grandparents, is from Mexico. This is actually a confusing question for me, because I actually feel like I have two families, my mom's side and my dad's side, because they're no longer together. So, but let's stick to my mom's, because that's who I grew up with. My mom had the experience in Texas, and we're talking about this borderlands area where Gloria Anzaldúa actually grew up. It's that exact same. I went to that college.
Wow. Where she grew up.
My mom had the experience of being raised in the United States, going to Catholic schools where they would hit you if you spoke Spanish. So growing up, my experience with my family and with my community, I did not know any Spanish, because my mother already had the experience of quite literal corporal punishment for speaking Spanish. So over time, she just decided that she was going to teach me English and only English, because that was the language of power to her. That was the language that didn't get you in trouble. So the people that I generally hung out with back home in Texas were just primarily English speakers. So I think all of us considered ourselves Mexican American, some of us more American than Mexican, some of us a little bit more close to our Mexican side, a little closer to our grandparents, a little closer to our aunts and uncles that spoke Spanish. But for me, I really ended up drifting towards the people I could communicate with, the people that could speak English to me. It wasn't until much later in adulthood that I just decided to personally try to speak Spanish again. And it's something that I'm still feeling like I'm learning it, and it's, and it gets us into that weird notion of what makes a bilingual. Mm-hmm. Because in my head, I know that I'm 100%, or, you know, I comprehend, you know, 95% of what is said to me. But when I'm asked to speak, that's where, you know, I get into problems. I start stumbling over words, and then I start getting insecure. So in general, the community that I would always hang out with were people that probably identified more with their American English speaking side, even though the area that I come from is, like I said, 90-95% Latinx people. A really interesting region, deep South Texas, surrounded by Border Patrol checkpoints on all the sides, you know.
Right.
So there's a lot of people there that never leave the region because they can't cross the checkpoints. So let's say they're, you know, first generation or whatever, but their parents can't cross the northern checkpoint. They might stay in the region until they're an adult, to where they can cross the checkpoint themselves. So, right. So the region itself is kind of described as very isolated. It's a very isolated region. I don't think it's as isolated as people make it seem, but that's the very common myth to the community. Everybody is always trying to get out of that particular region in Texas. And they think that there's something better beyond the checkpoint, beyond the northern checkpoint. They think there's something better north of this little borderland town, this little borderlands region in Texas. It's a very common experience to probably most of the community there.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing these experiences and a little bit of your background. A couple of things that got me interesting in what you just said. Two things that when you're talking about is confusing and it's a little bit difficult to talk about this background. It makes sense for our communities in North America that it's confusing and it's difficult because our lives have been difficult and confusing themselves. Mm-hmm. Now, when it comes to education, when these students, these children come to our classrooms, sometimes teachers do not understand that background. And that's most of the problem, is that people refuse to understand that background, to the point that you were giving the example of your mother being, punished because speaking Spanish. Mm-hmm. So that traumatic experience for speaking Spanish, a lot of people do not understand that we all come with different baggages and with different experiences when it comes to the classroom. So for us, at least for the work that I do, is to raise awareness that our students are coming with all of these things, so we can actually create spaces in our classrooms that are safe for these students, so they can be thrive and be better in the academic world, so to speak. Then the other thing that got me interesting was this idea that you said something like something's better in the north. And because I work in comparative international education, this is something that comes all the time, the idea that the north is always better. So the north meaning Europe, then the north meaning North America, the north meaning the north of the city where the wealthy white people are, and so on and so forth. And this is the idea that we always want to pursue the best, and the best is the north, and the best is the north, and the north is white, and the north means speaking English, et cetera, et cetera, and so on and so forth. So now I'm trying to connect the idea of going to the north, like all of us that travel from the South or America or the south of the border to the north. Mm-hmm. Some people consider us Latinos, some others consider us Latinx, et cetera, et cetera. So for you, now that you're an adult, how do you see yourself as a Latino or Latinx, and do you see any difference? How does this work?
So that is a very interesting question, and almost directly related to the field work that I do. So this region that I'm talking about, it's interesting because it is north of the border, but it's south of the checkpoint. And like you said, everybody wants to go north, more north, more north, right?
Right.
When I ask people, and this is including me, I ask them, what do you identify as? And I get this blank stare, like, what do you mean? So I rephrase it. Is there a race group that you identify with, or like an ethnicity that you identify with? And it's a very common response that, or the most common response that I got was a blank stare, as if they had never been asked this question before in their life. Even right now, when you ask me that question, I still don't know how to answer it, right? Like, for example, I asked a whole bunch of people this question. This is because I thought it was going to be an easy question. This was like, oh, you know, this is a warm-up kind of interview question. That way people can get comfortable and start talking to me. And that question ended up being the most violent blocking conversation blocker ever. So I eventually I had to stop asking that question. But some people would say, oh, I think, you know, I'm Hispanic because my parents were from Spain. My great-great-great-grandparents were from Spain or something like that. Or maybe they'll say, like, I think I would be Chicana, but I'm not really political enough, so maybe I wouldn't be that. Maybe I would be Mexican-American, but I'm undocumented, so maybe just Mexican. Or I think I'm Tejana or Tejano. Mm-hmm. And me, myself, what do I identify as? I mean, I'm not sure, because I guess in academic circles, the most category is Latinx. But I personally don't feel very much of a connection to that. I don't feel much of a connection to Latino either. I guess the one that I feel the strongest connection to is Mexican-American. That's the one that I would probably fall back on, depending on the context. If it's right. An institutional context, Latinx, because that sounds the most modern. It has the most modern ring to people for whatever reason, you know. It's a very confusing question to me, being a person from this region. A lot of us don't really know if Mexican is considered a race. Or is Mexican or Mexican-American, is that considered an ethnicity or is that a nationality? If you ask them, I would follow up questions like, well, is Mexican a race? And they're like, no, that's a nationality. So you're identifying as Mexican. Does that mean you don't have a race? And they're like, well, of course I have a race. But if you press them on the issue, it ends up falling apart, because it's just not a conversation people have in this area, this borderlands area, where I think from the perspective outside, with Anzaldúa's work, we get this perception that it's a place of struggle. It's a territory of struggle. And I think that struggle comes out when you ask that very simple question, how do you identify? And I good luck getting somebody to answer that question in any straightforward way. It's a very complicated question to anybody from there. And I keep saying from there, because that's the only place that I feel it. I don't want to essentialize the area either, but that's where I feel comfortable speaking from. That's my particular standpoint, as opposed to what kind of Latinx person, or what a Latinx person in New York, how would they answer that question? It would be very different from the way I would answer that question coming from South Texas, you know?
Right. No, it's very interesting, because as you speak, it made me think of me asking the same question, and a lot of people have asked me that question. So you're Latino. I mean, they see me right away. Oh, this little guy, brown, you know, like Latino, right away, mm-hmm. right out the bat, without any question, without any doubt. But asking the question to myself again is like that part of my identity changes depending on the location, as you were mentioning earlier.
Right.
Like when I am here in Canada, I have a Canadian passport, so I say I'm Canadian. Mm-hmm. When I travel to Colombia, then I say I'm Colombian. And when I travel within South America, if I go to Peru, Ecuador, etc., so I show my Colombian passport, I say I'm Colombian. Mm-hmm. But when I go to Europe, last year I got the chance to go into Europe, and then everywhere I go, I would say I am Canadian. And then people would look at me like, what do you mean you're Canadian? I say, yeah, I'm Canadian. And they look at me up and down because you don't see me, but I'm short. I'm 1 meter 50 centimeters, sort of like that, five feet two, something like that. So I'm short. So they look at me up and down and say, but wait a minute, how come you're Canadian? I say, yeah, I'm Canadian. And they sort of don't believe because, you know, we have discussed this long time ago, like the idea that because Canadian means white, tall, skinny, green eyes, blonde, you know, all of those sorts of things. And I don't look like the ideal of a Canadian is. So I had a couple of like critical conversations when I was both in England and Denmark as well, like having those conversations. And interesting enough, the conversations were not necessarily with English people or people from, or Danish people. It was more from Americans who were like visiting the areas, not believing that I was Canadian. But the other ones, you know, the Europeans, where they were like, oh sure, why not, you are Canadian. But so then again we go back to the idea of this identity, where are we from, or what is the label that we use, right? Mm-hmm. And then I don't use the label Hispanic because various folks here in Canada, in Toronto, we have this fight against some part of the government that keep putting ourselves Hispanic, and Hispanic is anti-black because it's portraying the European white settler as opposed to black indigenous people who were born in Latin America, right? So I don't use Hispanic at all because although I have a heritage from Spain, I'm assuming a long time ago. So I'm more towards the idea of what we call mestizo. If I were to ask that, I would use the word mestizo, which is indigenous / Spanish. Right. But anyhow, the idea of that, the Latinx is always a question that is being asked. I like Latinx better than Latino, Latina, because I like the X, the idea of non-binary kind of thing that I helping out in solidarity with the transgender people as well. So that's what I prefer, Latinx, at least in different circles as well. I like this conversation a lot. I wonder if like at some point in your life you have experienced any challenges, or what you can help us understand if you have faced any challenges while being who you are, Latinx, like people mock you, people make fun of you, I don't know, accent or some kind of trouble that you got because of how you look as a Latinx person or Latino, Mexican-American?
That's an interesting question. It's interesting because so I guess 29 years old is when I actually first left my community in South Texas. Mm-hmm. And since it's mostly Latinx down there, I never experienced anything very explicit as far as, I would get weird looks because of the way I look, but that was more having to do with the fact that I have a red beard and I have long hair and tattoos and things like that. But I never experienced anything particularly racial. There was this one moment that, again, as a person of color, I don't know if I was just being paranoid. I might have been being paranoid, but maybe not. I was sitting in a coffee shop in Virginia, and I could swear the corner that I was in, which was basically four couches facing each other in this like little square, and then there's the rest of the coffee shop. I was sitting on one of those couches, and very slowly, people left and went to go sit on tables, or they left the coffee shop or whatever. So after about 45 minutes, I noticed very explicitly that I was sitting there by myself in this coffee shop, and the coffee shop was pretty full. There, all the tables were taken up, but I was the only person there. And I had to wonder if it was because of race. This is a town that has, you know, Confederate flags, Donald Trump, regalia on people's heads. That was the first time that my Mexican Americanness became very explicit to me. Other than that experience, I would just say that being in academia, feeling the tiny moments of exclusion, that was probably more relevant to my life, noticing that, oh, you know what, I don't speak the same as these other students. I always felt like I spoke in this simpler manner, when in actuality, now thinking back, I realized that these students, having a different kind of academic background, had already mastered this particular academic linguistic register that was very dependent on the listener to fill in all the context and all the details. They were speaking at this abstract level that made no direct reference to almost anything. And the way that I spoke was, I guess, could be perceived as very literal. And I felt that every time I opened my mouth, that everything that came out of me was not abstract enough. It was too literal. There wasn't enough room for interpretation in what I was saying. And after a couple years, I think I pretty much stopped speaking. I mean, not even after a couple of years. After about a semester in graduate school here in New York, I stopped speaking in class, just completely. I didn't want to. I just sounded too different from everybody else. This is a diverse cohort. You know, there were international students. There's like students from Egypt and countries all around the world. About half the students were white. And I think the international students, or at least in my head, there was an expectation to be seen as other. While me being American, I did not have the expectation of being seen as other. I had always been in my community for my entire life. And then stepping into this place where it wasn't 90, 95% Latinx, I was other. And a lot of it had to do with the way I spoke.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a painful experience, because I had always thought of myself as, you know, a little smarter than usual. I was very confident about my, you know, intellectual abilities. There was no hesitation to say anything before right. I left my home until I got here. So as far as like being explicitly racialized, no, I've never had any kind of explicit moment like that. But feeling or perceiving myself as being racialized linguistically, yes, that is the story of my entire academic life. It's exactly that.
I see exactly what you mean. You know, a similar thing happens here at the University of Toronto, OEC, and we call this OEC language. We call it Académis. So do you know Académis or you don't know Académis? Académis is the language of the academia, right? And once you enter here, you don't know it, and somehow you start learning this code, as you said, this linguistic code, and then if you don't learn it, you are immediately pushed out from the others. This doesn't happen like up front. It's just like, it's so subtle that you start feeling like, oh. And then our job is to learn, to figure out the code, to survive. That's how I see it. And I also see it as a kind of elitism. Mm-hmm. I remember the first semester or something like that, I went to a presentation. And the person presented, and there was this person in the back sort of raising their hand to ask a question to the presenter. And this person was speaking with these words that I at that time, I didn't know those words, but it sounded intelligent, right?
Yes.
But then you can feel you can feel that the tension that the person is sort of asking these questions, quote unquote, challenging questions to show off his expertise in the field and sending Absolutely. The message that I know. You don't know, I know how to express myself in this language, and you don't know. And for me, it become elitism, like, you know, like you are from another caste, and I'm from this lower caste that I will never achieve. And it became a whole journey until today. Like, I still perceive it, not like in the past, but I still perceive it, and it's persistent. And sometimes people don't see it that way, because that's how the system has been built, in such a way that you have to behave that way.
Yes, absolutely. Or I remember explicitly in some of my classes, the use of Latin words, Latin phrases, or French words and French phrases. I just always thought to myself, was it necessary to throw in this particular specialized jargon from your field that potentially nobody else in this classroom knows, but you're going to use it anyways so that you can posture yourself as an expert of something? And it's, I still get thrown off, like presenting at conferences, the questions portion at the end of, let's say you give a paper or you're on a panel and you have to take questions from the audience. To me, that's always the worst part, because I know inevitably there's going to be somebody in the audience that is going to ask me a question that is so abstract, so full of potential interpretation, it throws me off and makes me think, I hope I'm interpreting what they are saying to me correctly, which I feel like it shouldn't be on me to interpret this person's question, or rather, it shouldn't be on me to narrow down this massive amount of interpretations that could potentially be in this question. It just always makes me insecure taking questions at conferences. It's just something that I'm trying to deal with, and you can tell the academics that are very experienced in taking these kinds of questions, because they'll throw back an abstract answer that almost says nothing, but it says enough to make that person feel like there was a potential answer in there. It's just still a common experience, and I mean, I hope I can control this linguistic register at some point in my life, you know. I mean, I'm better at it now, but it's not the way that I want to project myself. It just doesn't feel like me anymore.
Right.
This is a big reason why I started my YouTube channel. I explicitly did not want to have to talk like that. And right. I knew there was other students, other people of color, other scholars of color that didn't talk like that either. And I wanted to speak the way I spoke. I wanted to speak the way I imagined, you know, other scholars of color speaking, without the pressure to throw in as much jargon, as many big words, as to speak as abstract as possible. I just took it upon myself to say, hey, you know what? I'm going to take this article or this book chapter, and I'm going to put it into words that I would say in everyday life. If I had to explain this to my mother, she'll understand it.
Right.
You know, if I had to explain it to my friend in a coffee shop, or my, you know, my band member, they'll understand it too. Because a lot of the stuff isn't hard. It's just that the jargon, the academic ease, you know, it just excludes a whole lot of people, and it prevents a whole lot of people from approaching these forms of knowledge. And, you know, what is our job as an academic? What are we supposed to do? You know, I consider myself as someone who's trying to, I guess, translate this total overblown academic register into a kind of talk that people can actually relate to and people can actually incorporate into their regular everyday life. You know, that was the whole reason why I started the YouTube channel from the beginning.
Right. Yeah, no, I would actually, this is a good segue to talk about your YouTube channel. Tell us a little bit about your YouTube channel. You already started saying the reasons behind you creating the YouTube channel. How is it going? How successful is it being? How about comments to your YouTube channel that you have got? What has been one of the most amazing things that you have seen as an outcome of producing this channel?
Right. Okay, so for the listeners that don't know, the channel is called The Social Life of Language, or you can just search my name, Mike Mena, M-E-N-A. And it has an interesting backstory, and it's directly related to higher education and the lack of resources for students, particularly students of color. The whole point of that channel was to make media for other scholars of color in a way that was easy but not condescending. At that point in my student life, I knew there was something just utterly disgusting about how the PhD classroom was organized, all the Latin words thrown around, all the French words, about a million different ways a person can feel excluded on the basis of linguistic practice alone. And, you know, and I hated it. I listened to my classmates talk. The words and concepts and phrases of their sentences made so much room for interpretation. It could just mean anything. And it could be, like I said, it was up to the listener to fill in the blanks. And I didn't have this linguistic register. I knew it. I didn't have the ability to obscure all the definitive reference in my speech, to talk at this level of abstraction that leaves all the work to the listener to fill in the context. So I just sat there thinking, you know, someone please just be real to me. And I don't mean based on concrete reality. I just mean something that the interpretation didn't require so much work. You know, you only have, when you're answering these questions in class, you only have a couple sentences to say something. But the kind of answers or the kind of statements you're expected to make, it almost felt like people were trying to articulate an entire book idea or an idea that should be the length of a book into this like one sentence. So the YouTube was directly related to the fact that I would also search YouTube looking for more resources about whatever I was studying, and then finding professors that were explaining things in the exact same academic register that I didn't understand in class, in the classroom. And I remember looking for like Harvard classes or Princeton classes, thinking that, oh, you know, these are big universities. They must have great teachers. They must have people that can speak in a way that teaches a lot of students, since they're such prestigious universities. And I found the exact same thing there, that I could not understand what they were saying. So I just said, hey, you know what? My first video was on Foucault, and I was like, I'm going to make this the easiest possible explanation of Foucault that I can possibly make it, you know? And to this day, that still has the most views. I think it's like 20,000 views at this point or something. And it was a really interesting experience, feeling like such an outsider in the classroom, and then always being positioned as an expert outside of the classroom. And very quickly, I started being invited to talks to explain Foucault as an expert in the realm of academia in the classroom. While I was sitting in the classroom, I was completely silent. I would never say anything, but somehow outside of the classroom, I was positioned as an expert. And over time, I got a little bit more deep into the language studies. I do linguistic anthropology. So I wanted to do some of the linguistic scholarship that dealt with race. And I did the Everyday Language of White Racism by Jane Hill. That was like my first attempt at a non-Foucault book, because up to that point, I had only been doing Foucault videos. And then at some point I thought, hey, you know what? I'm going to try to do scholars of color. I'm going to try to get other scholars of color, their work out there too. Jane Hill did not need my help to get any more recognition. She's already, you know, she's already up there. So I just thought, you know, other scholars of color need to see other scholars of color doing the kind of work that they are interested in too. So I started looking into scholars of color and, doing YouTubes on their videos, and very slowly over time, emails would be trickling in, like saying, hey, you know, your video was really good. I'm going to assign it in my classroom. That was the first time somebody emailed me to contact me to say they're going to assign it in their classroom. That was a really happy moment. And then I started getting these emails regularly. And then the comments that were coming out on the YouTube videos too were very inspiring as well. Like, hey, you did this way better than my professor. Or, hey, I used this to help me write this paper. Or hey, I'm definitely gonna assign these videos in my classroom. And then all of a sudden, the Society for Linguistic Anthropology contacted me saying that, hey, you just won the award for public outreach.
Wow.
And I was like, wow, really? Like, it felt good receiving a form of recognition from such an, you know, a quote unquote official, you know, very kind of established field in academia, you know, and today I'm like trying to figure out the funding. I did actually get a really big grant to, you know, really up my video equipment and my audio equipment. What was another? Oh, I have just been hired to do a YouTube workshop for other academics interested in starting their own YouTube channel. These are all very interesting experiences in the sense that I keep being positioned as an expert in academia, in something that in academia where I felt like a total complete outsider for 90% of my experience in academia. Only now with this YouTube do I actually feel like, oh, you know, I've created this little space for myself, and I created a little space for other scholars of color that can, you know, approach material without being so intimidated by the language right off the bat. So that was the whole purpose of the academic YouTube. It was, hey, I know I'm a good teacher. I taught in high school. I know how to connect with students. Let me see if I can take that online and help out other people that are having such a hard time in academia as a person of color. Let me see if maybe somebody out there, you know, wants my help, or let me see if I can actually do something good potentially with this media platform. That's the story. That's how YouTube. That's how my academic, quote unquote, academic YouTube channel was started. That's the story.
No, I think that's amazing. I think this is a great story. That's one of the reasons why I followed your work, because I think you have addressed a gap out there that is there, and then you're filling that gap. And I am glad that somebody finally took the time to do some kind of work specifically related to the idea of highlighting or enhancing or amplifying the work of scholars of color. Mm-hmm. And I think this is a fabulous work, and I invite you and other folks to keep working on the idea of highlighting the work of those people who have been doing amazing work for a long time, but they don't have the recognition, right? Like the example that you were giving of Foucault is a good example of why not talking about Foucault, but he has so many things and a lot of people have talked about him. Why not is talking about other folks who have doing amazing work for a long time from the Global South, and they don't have the recognition. Like, for example, scholars of color like Silvia Rivera Cusicanqui from Bolivia has an amazing work, and a lot of people don't know. A lot of people in Latin America, like in Colombia, Ecuador, Peru, you know, have been doing amazing work in terms of race, linguistics, all of those sorts of things. And something that I noticed, which is unfortunately that I've seen, is like people from the South take the theories and ideas from the North and take it as they are theirs without necessarily thinking we have our own theories, we have on our own academic work, but therefore this idea of power of the North, going back to the idea that we take those theories from the North and put them in the Global South as if they were there, right? That's why I insist that the work that you do, and I encourage you to keep doing it, because I think it's very important not only for North America in general, but also for anybody who wants to follow up on this idea of disseminating the knowledge people who have been at the margins, I think is very important. And yes, definitely, I'm also teaching a master's class in a university. And then I also put two of your videos as part of the course, because I told them, go ahead and watch Mike Mena's video, because that's going to help you a little bit to understand and to unpack a little bit of the readings that we've been doing for whatever week we do. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, what else? So I had a couple more questions before we finish today, because I am aware of your time, and then we may be wrapping up soon. But mm-hmm. I would like to talk about a little bit about the things that you and I, we connect and we have talked about. And I think that will be really cool for the audience to get to know a little bit of those personal things that we have shared. The idea of culture and music. I don't know if the audience knows, but Mike has a band, and he plays on a regular basis, or maybe not on a regular basis, in a band, a metal band. And then me also, I back in the day, in the 90s, I used to play on a metal band as well. And then sort of it's not disconnected at some point. That's how I learned English, by being in one metal band. It helped me to practice my English, sing the lyrics in English, and et cetera, et cetera. So Mike, tell us a little bit about that as you wish. You don't have to tell us the whole story, but tell us a little bit that your metal band.
Oh yeah. So the metal band is located in that same region, South Texas. Everybody in the band is also Latinx. It's called Severance, like severance pay, but just the word severance. I've been in that band since, I believe, 2003, something like that, about 15 years. And it's been a great experience. I've gotten to travel all over Europe a couple of times. Next year, I believe we are going to do some kind of Latin American mini tour. Just like 3 or 4 countries, I think is what's on the radar right now. But it's a very interesting experience, and I always feel a bit conflicted with the person that I am today versus the person that performs in this group, because we are talking about a death metal band, and we are talking about the death metal genre, which is known for, you know, very extreme forms of sexism in particular. Now, my band does not do that, but, you know, I am in a crowd where it's mostly men. You know, maybe 2 or 3 women show up to the shows every now and then, but it's definitely an interesting experience when I go home to play, because I do live in New York. The band remains in Texas, so a lot of times how we do it is we will be very selective about our shows. We pick the so-called big ones, or the ones where we get to open for a really famous band, or ones that we get to headline the entire show, or headline the entire fest. We're very selective, and I basically just fly back and forth and go play a show, kind of dip my toes back into that old crowd that I was, you know, very involved in for a whole lot of years already. And then I kind of reached my limitation by the end of a couple days, a couple nights, being in that environment, that it feels like it's part of the older person that I used to be. But it's still fun. When it stops being fun, then I won't do it anymore. But yeah, it's taken me, you know, all around the world a couple times. Not around the world. It's taken me all around Europe a couple times. It's been really fun. Let's see how long I can do it. It is very damaging to the voice. I do the vocals, and when you go for months without doing these kinds of vocals, which is just basically yelling and grunting, it kind of hurts. You know, it hurts the voice a little bit. And jumping around on stage when I'm so used to sitting in coffee shops now, my physical activity is walking to a coffee shop, sitting down with a book, and then walking back home, and then sitting down with a book again. That's very different from jumping around a stage and getting involved with a crowd and you know, screaming my head off basically into a microphone. It's always an interesting experience going down to play a show. But what about your band? You still got it going? I know it was like a one man.
Well, the thing is that back in the 90s, I used to play in a grindcore, social political grindcore band. Mm-hmm. And then we used to play lyrics in English, and I was the one who was supposed to make the lyrics in English, and everything was related to politics, the war, the violence, all of those sorts of things. And then, yeah, I played like for 5 years. Again, like you, I was the vocalist. So mm-hmm. I understand the idea of the pain in your throat after the shows, all of those sorts of things. And then because I left Colombia in 2000, so I stopped that project. But then I follow up on a harsh noise project, which is a sub-range of the electronic genre, right? Mm-hmm, and then that's mm-hmm. what I'm doing it on my own, just playing around with different kinds of pedals, different so synthesizers, oscillators, all electronic music that is a little bit harsh. But I still have the idea of this of the socio-political thing. And somehow I do not disconnect my social justice oriented themes with my band, which is hybrid frequency. And then I connect those things and I go on a stage again, and then I sort of perform with that mindset, the idea of sending a message of social justice against the violence, against the murder of indigenous women in Canada, for example, mm-hmm. all of those sorts of things. So in a sense, I still believe that we, the scholars, the researchers, we also have to set aside a little bit of time for personal things related to the arts, related to something, because otherwise we would get crazy to just reading about Foucault and reading about Bourdieu and all of these
things. Exactly.
So that would be too much. So I always encourage my peers to stop reading too much, stop doing writing papers, stop doing that, go out and have fun and do something on the side that is totally opposite of what we're doing. And I'm glad that you sort of share with us your personal side of having a band, sort of so that our audience understand that we are not only just these academics who are with our computers and books mm-hmm. and dictionaries and behind a screen typing papers. So there is we always have a life on the side.
I actually. Death metal is the way that I got into academia. It's interesting. My first master's degree was in ethnomusicology, and I wanted to study metal and politics. So I wrote this whole paper on the band Brujeria.
Yeah.
And I focused on translation. I focused on what the word huero meant in different contexts, and I didn't know it at the time, but that was probably my introduction to linguistic anthropology, sociolinguistics, language studies, just in general, just focusing on how that word got translated transnationally or not even transnationally, just different regions or different locations in the United States. That's probably how I got into academia with death metal.
If you have that paper available, that would be great, so we can put it here in the comments and people can actually have a look at them. Is it publicly available or not?
It probably is, but oh my goodness, I don't think I would put that out publicly. I read it a few years ago, and I wasn't such a good writer back then. I made some mistakes.
That's why we all make mistakes. So maybe if our audience is curious about that paper, they may want to Google it.
Oh boy. Oh gosh. Please don't. Please don't. Or if you do, send me a nice email saying like, oh, Mike, you were really young and this was good for, 5 years ago, 10 years ago.
Definitely. All right, Mike, thank you so much for coming today to the podcast. I wonder if, to wrap up, do you have any other extra comments that you want to share with our audience about you, your work, your research, any funny moments, anything that you want to share to wrap up?
I'm kind of on this the last YouTube video I made on imposter syndrome has gotten a lot of interesting responses. I talk about moving away from imposter syndrome to imposter training, which is just, you know, moment to moment feelings of imposterness that persons of color experience. And if there's any words of encouragement that I'd want to send out there is that, you know, you are not the problem. If you're a scholar of color, you are not the problem. Academia is a institution driven by racial ideologies. So just stay in there, keep trying, surround yourself with other people of color, other scholars of color, people who know you're not making shit up, people who know you're not being paranoid, and just keep at it. It'll get better if you're having a hard time. And, you know, look for people who are like you making media. You know, there's my stuff, there's your stuff. And there's a whole lot of podcasts right now out for talking specifically about racism and specifically about, you know, language justice and whatnot. So if you're having a hard time in school, you know, just look around for media. It's out there, and you know, you're not alone. There's other people who experience things just like you too. So just keep at it.
Yeah, exactly. So I think with that idea, we're going to finish our podcast today to let our audience to know you are not the problem. Keep trying, surround yourself with people like yourself, support each other, support your community, because that's the only way we actually going to survive in this in these institutions.
Absolutely.
Mike Mena, thank you so much for coming today. I hope everybody have a wonderful rest of the week. Thank you so much.
Thanks, man.